Today's podcast is brought to you by HydroJug. They make hydration easy.
Well, actually, Stacey, their tagline is hydration made easy.
Okay. I know we're joking, but seriously, I mentioned before how I got Matt one of these for work and how it reduced his caffeine cravings and helped his energy to not be dehydrated. But recently, he was using his backup, another brand, and it broke. Guess which one is still going strong?
I'm going to guess the HydroJug, because the carry loop and integrated handle means it's accessible to carry with wherever you go.
Indeed. And I love how durable it is. You don't have to only be super active with them. I like to leave one on my desk to make sure I'm getting my daily water intake. It means less time on refills. And with the wide mouth, you can add things like supplements, ice, or fruit to the BPA-free jug.
Water science fact. 75% of Americans are chronically dehydrated. Water is crucial to your health. Every cell and tissue inside your body requires water to function. And as we've talked about on the show before, hydration is even important for the gut microbiome. And not just any amount of water, but about a gallon a day could make a really huge impact on your overall health.
And HydroJug holds half a gallon of water. And to recap, it has a wide mouth opening. Actually, I got their straw inserts. I love those.
Me too.
And it has an integrated handle with an optional carrying loop. It's dishwasher safe and shatterproof.
And the sleeve has a great pocket for things like cell phone and keys too. It's fantastic for hikes or camping that way. Plus, by choosing HydroJug, you are becoming part of the movement to stop the waste, since every day, roughly 60 million plastic water bottles are thrown away.
HydroJug is offering you 10% off with code WHOLEVIEW. Head to thehydrojug.com to customize your jug and use code WHOLEVIEW for 10% off your purchase.
That's thehydrojug.com/discount/WHOLEVIEW.
All the feels on this one.
Because that's what the science says.
Welcome to The Whole View. I'm Stacey Toth of Real Everything. I'm all about loving the skin you're in and being healthy inside and out.
Let's talk about what this looks like in real life.
Facts do not have opinions.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of thepaleomom.com. I believe that scientific literacy is the key to improving public health.
Just don't let perfection be the enemy of the good.
Science is true, whether or not you believe in it.
Self-love is really about self-respect. Welcome back, listeners. This is The Whole View, episode 477. You are going to be shocked. Sit down. You're going to hear about vegetables today.
But not just any vegetables. We're going to talk about my favorite family, group, class, genus of vegetables, the cruciferous vegetables.
I will say, other than nightshades, this is the group of vegetables that we get the most questions on, because there's so many myths and rumors about cruciferous vegetables. Like, really? Where's this coming from? Who has it out against cabbage?
It's people who want an excuse to not eat Brussels sprouts, spreading lies.
Well, they obviously have never had roasted Brussels sprouts. That's because, it. Honestly, I'd prefer that over popcorn, so...
I was listening to, this is a complete tangent, a really fascinating, I think it was like an NPR bit on Brussels sprouts. And apparently they have been selectively bred over the last few decades to be less bitter. So one of the reasons why we all like Brussels sprouts now and hated them as kids is because they're actually like tastier than they used to be.
Well, also because people were boiling them and serving them from cans. So that didn't
Mom,
help either.
I love you, but boiled Brussels sprouts are gross.
She knows. She knows. Okay. Let's dive into this question, because I'm actually jazzed to jump into this topic. Anything you ever wanted to know about cruciferous vegetables, you're going to learn today. I've already looked at the notes. I don't know how Sarah can come up with 8 pages of notes on a vegetable group, but we're going to do it. And if you don't even know what cruciferous vegetables are, we're going to tell you. We also have a lot of shows on vegetables. If you're new here, we're big fans. They're good for you. We're going to talk about that. But you can look back at some of our older vegetable shows. Basically anything vegetable, Whole View is a good Google search. But episodes 152, 286, 335, 373, we talked about all about vegetables and then how many vegetables, part 2, 3, 4. And then episodes 304 and 424 were other popular vegetable shows where we talked about cooking vegetables or eating them raw, which I know we're going to touch on today. And then also when Sarah gave us the absolute bomb that we need to have 30 vegetables or fruits in a week. And I had a little bit of a panic attack, and then I counted up my vegetables and I was hitting the mark. And as a reminder, I have a meal plan every Monday on my blog where I make sure that we're getting you 30 fruits and vegetables, a variety of them every single week, including cruciferous vegetables, which honestly happen to be one of my favorites simply because they're so affordable and versatile.
I completely agree. They're probably served for dinner every single night of the week in this house, or just about anyways. But let's read Janet's question and kind of dive into it, because I can't tell you how excited when I saw this question come through. I was like, yes, an opportunity to nerd out about this wonderful family of vegetables. So Janet wrote, "Hello, Stacy and Dr. Sarah. I'm a brand new listener, and I am so glad I found your podcast. I find myself laughing as much as I am learning, so thank you. I wanted to know your take on cruciferous vegetables. I have heard they should only be eaten rarely and never raw or juiced. Is there any truth to that, and why would that be the case? Apologies if you have already covered this on a past show. Thank you both for sharing your own struggles with us openly. I feel like I just gained 2 new friends, and my Fridays just got even better. Thanks, Janet."
My face looks like that emoji that wants to give people hugs with, like, hearts going around in a circle. I'm like, oh, Janet, you're so nice. Good job, because that's how your questions get read at the show. Kidding. I'm mostly kidding. I do want to just, there is one truth to what Janet says, which is don't juice your vegetables. We have also covered that in a show where we talked about juicing. I definitely encourage you to go back and listen to that. Sarah is going to talk a lot about gut health. And in order for that to apply, you need fiber. So I'm just going to, that's my non-scientist answer to Janet's question. And then Sarah, you can tackle all the rest.
Perfect. So check that one off the box. Let's start with taking a big step backwards, because I think a lot of people don't even know what the word cruciferous means and what family of vegetables this refers to. So it's typically referred to as the cabbage family. There are any vegetables that are members of the Brassica genus or the Brassicaceae family. So they're called cruciferous because that comes from the Latin crucifere, which means cross-bearing, and it refers to the shape of the flowers of these plants. But it basically includes everything related to cabbage. So actually, fun fact, cabbage, Savoy cabbage, Napa cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, collard greens, kohlrabi, gailan, and kale are all different cultivars of a single species. They're all the same species of plant, which is Brassica oleraceae. Additional cruciferous vegetables are generally cultivars of Brassica rapa, which means they're all also another species. That includes turnips, bok choy, and rapini. And then there's also things like horseradish, watercress, gardencress, radish, daikon, collard greens, rutabaga, and mustard greens. They're all either called cruciferous vegetables or also brassicas, because that's the genus. So those are all interchangeable names for the same family of vegetables.
I could be done, because I've learned something new today already. maybe we should just run down for the layman what the handy dandy list might be of cruciferous veggies. Do you want to try to do a thing that we're terrible at and just like speed through this, alternate? I'll say one, you say one.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Okay.
Or terrible, but let's try it anyways.
Scary, exhilarating, all the things. Arugula.
Bok choy.
Broccoli.
Broccoli rab.
Broccoflower.
Broccoli romanesco.
Brussels sprouts.
Cabbage.
Canola, also known as rapeseed, really?
Uh-huh, yeah. But
We're terrible at this.
I know, it's true. We're already commenting. Okay, back on track. Cauliflower.
Chinese broccoli.
Collard greens.
Daikon.
Field pepper weed.
Flowering cabbage.
Garden cress.
Horseradish.
Kale.
Kohlrabi.
Komatsuna? I say,
you're so confident.
Having never eaten this vegetable before, but I feel like I just challenged myself to find it. It totally is. Yep.
Landcress.
Maca.
Mizuna.
Mustard.
Radishes.
Rapini.
Rutabaga.
Tatsoi.
Turnips.
Wasabi.
Watercress.
And wild broccoli.
As you can see, there's a lot, some of which none of us have ever had, some of which we love. I mean, some of these are my favorite vegetables.
I am in the middle of trying to establish a new kitchen garden in my backyard. It's been a huge project. It's currently about a 2-foot deep hole that's full of water because of how much rain we've gotten. But I have actually planted kale and tatsoi seeds to try to grow through the late fall because I'm going to try to grow something now. If I'm lucky with the weather, I'll actually get some cool stuff to eat.
All right. So now we know what cruciferous vegetables are. I think in order to get to Janet's question, maybe we could talk a little bit about shattering that myth. I'm just going to put it out there right now. We're going to shatter the myth. I'm not going to try to like tease you along. Just FYI, we both like them. So we're a little bit biased, but it does come from a science background. So Sarah, tell us about why we love cruciferous vegetables.
They are probably one of the best studied vegetables. And in part, it's because the health benefits signal from them is so strong. So when studies look at, you know, diet trends and whether or not those correlate with positive health outcomes, there's always this really strong signal from cruciferous vegetables. So that, of course, means that scientists want to investigate that further. And so they go and do more studies looking at how different families of fruits and vegetables and how cruciferous vegetables in particular can improve health. And so because of that, there's these huge systematic reviews and meta-analyses. Our listeners know that is my favorite kind of scientific study because it pools data from a bunch of other studies and then actually starts to hone in on magnitude of effect. So there was a systematic review looking at 95 studies evaluating fruit and vegetable intake and showed that eating about one serving of cruciferous vegetables per day, so about 100 grams, led to an average of an 18% decrease in ischemic stroke, a 17% decrease in hemorrhagic stroke, a 16% decrease in total cancer risk, and a 12% decrease in all-cause mortality and cardiovascular disease, independent of total fruit and vegetable intake, which is the really important part here. It means that as much as it's beneficial, and we've talked on the show approximately 6 million times about the importance of eating a diet abundant in fruits and vegetables, making sure that at least one of those is a serving of cruciferous vegetables can improve our health above and beyond the fact that it's just a vegetable.
That's incredible. Like literally my eyes did like the thing where they got really big as you were talking about that. And I love that it's independent from 30 fruits and vegetables a week, which might have people scared the way I was, but definitely go back and listen to that show. Cause we put your mind at ease. But, so I guess, are there human trials on, you know, actually seeing these or?
Yeah, so there have been a bunch of different clinical trials where they have looked at either people's habitual intake, like where that data that I just talked about came from. There's more different studies where they've looked at even higher levels of intake. So there was a study out of China where they compared the people who ate the most cruciferous vegetables. So they ate an average of 200 grams for men and 166 grams per day for women compared to the lowest intake, which was 28 grams for women and 34 grams for men, and showed that comparing the people who ate the most to the people who ate the least, there was a 31% reduced risk for cardiovascular disease mortality and a 22% risk of all-cause mortality. So again, like eating even more seems to have even more benefits. And there's also been studies where they have given people basically a high cruciferous diet for a certain amount of time. So there was really interesting one in 2014 where they had people eat, their formula was 0, 7, or 14 milligrams of cruciferous vegetables per kilogram body weight per day. It basically worked out to like 4 to 8 servings for 2 weeks. And they showed reduced markers of inflammation. The biggest change was in the inflammatory cytokine interleukin 6, which is really fascinating because interleukin 6 plays a pathological role in chronic inflammation and autoimmunity. So that's a lot of cruciferous vegetables to be eating. But at the same time, that was a big change seen over just 2 weeks of, you know, using cruciferous vegetables as an intervention. And then there's been a ton of like
perspective. Wait, can I ask a question? Sorry.
Yeah, of course.
Did you say that was per day or per week? Per week.
Per day. So they were eating 4 to 8 servings of cruciferous vegetables per day. It's a lot.
But I'm just calling this out because I think one of the myths that I often hear, and I know we'll get into this, has to do with autoimmunity. And so I want to like put a highlight, like a spotlight on the fact that 4 to 8 servings a day saw 20% reduction in an inflammatory marker that plays a significant role in autoimmunity. So we have science to support seeing this happen, because I know some of the things we're going to talk about are going to be like, well, so-and-so says. We try to always come back to the science and like, okay, I know that like logically someone might, you know, be postulating, but we're trying to look at the science here. And that's a pretty significant one for me to, you know what I mean? To some extent, am I going in circles here?
You are not. I'm really glad that you highlighted that. But I also want to highlight the reduced cancer risk, because, cruciferous vegetables, what makes them so special is that they have a very unique collection of organosulfur compounds called glucosinolates, and we can't get those in other foods, right? Onions have a different family of organosulfur compounds that also have a bunch of anti-cancer benefits, but they're additive, right? So because they're a different family of compounds, it's we can't get the same thing from onions. We can just get something kind of similar. So it'd be like saying we can get B vitamins from different foods, but it makes a difference if it's vitamin B6 or vitamin B12, right? Like it's still the same family of vitamins, but each vitamin has different effects. So because of that, cruciferous vegetables, that is the reason why cruciferous vegetables have benefits above and beyond just being vegetables. They also have all of the other things that vegetables have. What makes the glucosinolates from the cabbage family so special is that they have really strong anti-cancer properties. And this is seen in vitro. So it's seen in, you know, cell culture models, right? Seen in the petri dish, but also seen in studies in humans, which you asked about, Stacey, where they follow people for a very long period of time. They see what they eat as a baseline and follow and see their cancer risk. And the looking just at high versus low consumption. So we're talking about, again, sort of 1 to 2 servings per day versus, you know, not often having a cruciferous vegetable. It's associated with a 20% reduced bladder cancer risk, 15% reduced breast cancer risk, 18% reduced colorectal cancer risk, 21% reduced endometrial cancer risk, 19% reduced gastric cancer risk, 27% reduced liver cancer risk, 25% reduced lung cancer risk, 11% reduced ovarian cancer risk, 21% reduced pancreatic cancer risk, and 10% reduced prostate cancer risk. Those numbers are huge.
And just 1 to 2 servings a day.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, when we say things like 1 to 2 a day, it doesn't mean like you have to track your food and journal it like on a calendar. It just means, you know, if you're having on average 7 to 10 servings a week, that's going to kind of balance out and have the same effect, right? It's not like people need to be like, oh, I didn't get my kale today. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm like, now there was a long pause. I was like, maybe I'm wrong.
I was nodding away emphatically, forgetting again that this is an audio medium and none of our listeners can hear me nodding.
You'd think after this many years, you would know that, but that's okay. We forgive you. So I guess the other component of this is, and part of why, perhaps, also, right? Like, what is it in these vegetables that, in particular, has such health benefits? And one of the answers to that has got to be nutrients, right? Like, mm-hmm. cabbage, kale is such a cliche. Let's run with that one, right? But also, like, you know, you think about parents trying to force feed broccoli to their children and, like, all these things. And it's got to be because there is nutrient benefit to these lovely cruciferous vegetables.
Yeah. So it's not just all like one class of phytonutrients. Cruciferous vegetables are the most nutrient dense vegetables. They actually have the highest average nutrivore score of any fruits and vegetables or any animal foods that I have calculated. So I explained the nutrivore score recently on the podcast. It is a nutrient profiling method that I started developing actually almost a year ago. A little bit over a year ago, to help basically quantify the nutrient density of foods. And so this is a great time to mention that you can actually go to Nutrivore.com now and see my coming soon page. And you can sign up there to get my Nutrivore score guide to food groups there, where you can see how cruciferous vegetables compare to all of the other different very granular food groups, looking at fruit and vegetable families individually, right? Separating out nuts from seeds, that kind of super detail. So that's there. And also my new article on thepaleomom.com this week is about the Nutrivore score. So you can go there and read more about how that's calculated. But basically, this family of vegetables is crazy nutrient dense. It's not just glucose and oleates, although those are amazing, but it's basically a great source of most essential vitamins and minerals as well as things like polyphenols and fiber. And so actually, watercress is the highest Nutrivore score food that I have calculated so far at 9,481. And all of these are actually really good. Kale is at 4,162, broccoli at 3,647, collard greens at 6,329, bok choy at 4,729. Even the root, like members of this family, like rutabaga, is still 1,959. So to put that into context, those numbers are similar to organ meat, which we talked about not that long ago. Slash much higher than even the highest liver. All of the cruciferous vegetables make it into the top 100 Nutrivore score, like food list. Like every single one is in that list. They're just crazy nutrient dense. And if we look at sort of on average what this family has to offer us, they're a good source of fiber, of vitamin B9, folate. They're an excellent source of biotin, vitamin B7, of polyphenols, of vitamin C. They have, on average, 100% of the daily value of vitamin K. They have, on average, 50% of the daily value of vitamin C. They're really impressive. And, of course, glucose and oleates, studies show that about 15 milligrams daily is what is associated with all of these beneficial impacts. And so a one cup serving of cruciferous vegetables on average has 120% of that 15 milligrams. Two cups for leafy greens, I should mention. So that's also, I think it's helpful to sort of think about that serving. That one cup serving of cruciferous vegetables has an average of only 27 calories. So also when we're thinking about how a food contributes to the diet, we think about the nutrients per calorie. So if that food is only, right, 27 calories is 1.35% of a 2,000 calorie a day diet. So any nutrient that 27 calories is more than 1.35% of the daily value, it actually is really good. It means that those calories are providing us a great amount of nutrients, right? So if you had less than that 1.35%, then you would say that's a really underwhelming. So when we look at that as a level, now we see that cruciferous vegetables also provide an impressive amount of calcium, iron, magnesium, phosphorus, zinc, copper, manganese, selenium, vitamin B1, vitamin B2, vitamin B3, vitamin B5, vitamin A, carotenoids, vitamin E, alpha-linolenic acid, and even protein. Even protein, these vegetables offer an average of 6% of the daily value for that one cup serving that averages 27 calories. So there's actually very few nutrients that cruciferous vegetables aren't a good source of, and there tend to be those nutrients that are exclusive to animal foods like vitamin B12, vitamin D, functional fats, functional amino acids, and peptides. It's not a great source of choline. But generally, right, it's an awesome source of a bunch of nutrients and a really good source still of just about everything else.
And I love the idea that, for example, kale, 2 cups of leafy greens sounds like a lot, but if you cook kale, that's like 3 bites.
Yes.
It cooks down so much. And arugula is just one of those things, and now I'll have to keep an eye out for watercress now that I know how wonderful it is. It's just one of those things that you can add a handful to of another salad that you might be eating, except Sarah, who just like gnawing on raw romaine. But if you make yourself a bowl of salad, putting in like a handful of arugula is great. And I know Sarah's not a big fan, but I love smoothies. And it's interesting, my body will crave kale. Like usually I just use spinach because it's an easy thing that like the blender does better with. And so I get baby spinach. But sometimes my body will be like, nope, it's time for kale. And I do think that me personally, the more that I focus on this nutrivore mindset, right, of like really nourishing my body with the nutrients that it needs to thrive, the more that my body will tell me what it needs. It's not to say that that's a substitute for a medical professional or testing and supplementing and whatever it is you might need. But I know for me, if I my body will tell me if I listen. So I'm wondering, I know I'll eat, for example, kale raw in a smoothie, but it's also kind of like pre-digesting it for me in a smoothie. And I'll eat coleslaw with raw cabbage, but then I'm putting like lemon juice or an acid on it that's also kind of, you know, partially digesting it. When I think about how I eat these things raw, it's almost always like in a form that is supporting digestion before it gets into my body, if that makes sense. So one of the questions that Janet asked was, can cruciferous vegetables be eaten? Especially don't eat them raw is, you know, the myth that goes around. And maybe my body is telling me not to do that, but I'm wondering what the science is saying on whether or not to eat it raw.
Yeah, I think there's actually potentially an even better argument for eating them raw versus cooked. Not that cooked is bad, and we'll talk about that. But the glucosinolates in cruciferous vegetables, which are the phytonutrients we already talked about that have the super anti-cancer properties, but also, you know, antioxidants, anti-inflammatory, they're pretty amazing. It's not actually the parent molecule that is present in cruciferous vegetables that's beneficial. It is a metabolite, so a broken down version of that molecule that's beneficial for us. And the thing that breaks it down is an enzyme called myrosinase that is also in that plant. So what happens is when your broccoli is growing, the myrosinase and the glucosinolates are in different parts of the cell. And when you damage the plant, you crush it, you chew it, you slice it, those parts can meet. And then those glucosinolates get metabolized into other beneficial compounds, especially thiocyanates and isothiocyanates. And what's really important to know about that is that the enzyme, myrosinase, is not heat stable. So you only get that chemical reaction that produces the really good stuff when you're basically chewing them raw or you're blending them in a smoothie or you're somehow like crushing them before you consume them. In the plant, it creates more of a bitter flavor. So it's actually used by the plant as a defense mechanism to get, you know, bugs not to eat it, for example, because it makes it more bitter. But that bitterness is actually part of the sort of distinctive flavor of this family of vegetables. So it's not that when you're eating on raw broccoli compared to cooked, there it is a little bit more bitter. If you had both side by side and were really paying attention, you would notice, but it's not a huge effect. But some of the most beneficial isothiocyanates that are produced this way, for example, the most famous one is called sulforaphane, and it has like the most amazing properties. So it has all those amazing anti-cancer properties. It also helps to support phase two detoxification enzymes. So it helps the liver detoxify toxins. It can also help protect healthy cells from damage from environmental carcinogens. It upregulates a ton of our body's own antioxidant enzymes like glutathione, like my favorite hemoxygenase 1, which I studied for my PhD, but a whole pile of them. It has been shown to improve glycemic control in patients with type 2 diabetes. It has been shown to improve liver health. It is an anti-inflammatory. It has been shown to delay progression of osteoarthritis. It's been shown to be cardioprotective. It's been shown to potentially have neurodegenerative properties, even including in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. And it has antimicrobial activity against pathogens like H. pylori. It's actually been associated with reduced gastric ulcers and gastrointestinal cancers. So we maximize the benefits of things like sulforaphane and other isothiocyanates when we consume these raw. But I did promise that it is okay to eat them cooked, and that is true too. So what we talked about in episode 424 was that it's beneficial to eat vegetables both raw and cooked. Yes, cooking loses some nutrients. For example, the metabolites of glucosinolates and cruciferous vegetables, but it also forms others. And what we talked about on that show is that raw and cooked fiber feed different probiotic species in the gut microbiome. So we have benefit to both. It is okay to eat cruciferous vegetables cooked if you prefer roasted Brussels sprouts compared to a, you know, shaved Brussels slaw, which is delicious. If you haven't tried it, I definitely recommend trying it. But it's okay if you prefer them cooked, because studies have shown that we have bacteria in our gut microbiomes that also can make the myrosinase enzyme. So they can also do this important work of producing the actual glucosinolate metabolites that improve our health. And studies show that when we consume cruciferous vegetables regularly, our gut microbiome will have more species that can actually do that work for us. So there was a study in humans where they basically gave them a diet. Again, it was sort of like 4 to 8 servings of cruciferous vegetables a day, because it was based on body weight. And it was mainly cauliflower, cabbage, broccoli, and radish sprouts that they were eating. What was really interesting about the study is they showed that the change in the people's gut microbiomes was individual. So everyone kind of had a different change. There were certain things that happened to everybody. There was, for example, an increase in Elastipes bacteria, which are associated with a bunch of different health benefits, especially mental health and liver health, particularly. There was an increase in Eubacterium, which are really important short-chain fatty acid producers. So there was some changes that they could say happened in everybody, but most of what they could say was the shift was individual, and it seemed to be related to the baseline microbiota composition. But what was happening was the bacteria that were growing were the ones that had myrosinase enzymes. So they had the same metabolic functions. So basically everyone's gut microbiomes were adjusting to this increase in cruciferous vegetable intake so that they could benefit more from the glucosinolates in cruciferous vegetables. So that is very cool.
Today's podcast is brought to you by ButcherBox, yet another brand we have been using and loving for years. It's such a pinch me moment.
I agree. I love that we're able to offer such a great deal for you listeners, ground beef for life.
If you haven't heard of ButcherBox before, they're a certified B Corp that delivers humane and sustainably raised meat right to your door in 100% recyclable boxes. It's all super simple on their site with a variety of boxes to choose from, including a custom box, which is what we do.
ButcherBox has been essential for our family these last few years. Almost all of the meat and seafood we eat comes from ButcherBox. We were able to adjust the delivery frequency, both up and down as needed, and always with free shipping.
I love that ButcherBox focuses on reducing their carbon footprint too. Speaking of green, see what I did there?
Yes.
We're talking a lot about vegetables this episode, but one must also have protein, ideally quality protein with heart-healthy fats from being in the pasture and getting sunlight.
Oh gosh, yes. There are nutrients exclusive to plant foods and other nutrients that are exclusive to animal foods, and we need both to thrive. And high-quality meat like ButcherBox has even higher levels of important nutrients. For example, the conjugated linoleic acid content of grass-fed beef is up to 500% higher than grain-fed. And it has more omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin A, vitamin E, B vitamins, calcium, magnesium, and potassium.
And one of the things I love about ButcherBox is that they're focused on quality, both for you, the animal, and the planet. You can be assured the protein is grass-fed, finished, free-range, organic, humanely raised, and wild-caught.
This is your chance to never have to shop for ground beef again. That's right. ButcherBox is giving new members free ground beef for life. Sign up at butcherbox.com/wholeview and get 2 pounds of grass-fed ground beef free in every order for the life of your membership.
Log on to butcherbox.com/wholeview to claim this deal. I think you've laid out a lot of things. The question I want to dive into, the myth, the legend. I guess it's not a legend, but it was fun to say. Is about goitrogens. And I think a lot of people hear cruciferous vegetables are goitrogens, therefore do not eat them, especially if you have autoimmune, especially if you have thyroid, so many times from so many places. So can you tell us, what are goitrogens? Why is this a myth? And do you agree?
I would love to. So a goitrogen is any substance that interferes with thyroid hormone synthesis. And this is typically by blocking the activity of an enzyme called thyroid peroxidase, or TPO. People with Hashimoto's thyroiditis have their little thyroid radar buzzing. I don't know what thyroid radars do, but they're recognizing that because TPO antibodies are one of two antibodies that can result in Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So the other one being thyroglobulin antibodies. So people with autoimmune thyroid disorders or those with low thyroid function are often advised to avoid consumption of cruciferous vegetables because of their goitrogenic properties. And it's because in test tubes, in old studies, those same isothiocyanates and thiocyanates that are maximized when we eat raw vegetables, they would also be maximized if you put that vegetable into a smoothie or juiced it, because you're making the glucosinolates and the myrosinase enzyme mix together to make these really important health benefiting metabolites. They have been shown to inhibit thyroid peroxidase activity in vitro, right? So in a test tube. And there were some early studies where they looked at hypothyroidism caused by iodine deficiency in animals. Especially, there was a study that got a lot of attention done in rabbits that were eating a lot of cruciferous vegetables. So these rabbits specifically had iodine deficiency driven hypothyroidism and were eating a ton of cabbage. And it showed hypothyroidism was increased and they were forming goiters, right? So that also comes from the word goitrogen. But there's been a ton of studies done since that don't actually confirm this initial study. So even if those molecules have a mild effect inhibiting TPO, that's very different than saying it's going to cause hypothyroidism or it's going to cause a goiter. because it has all these other benefits that can benefit thyroid function, right? So there's been some really important animal studies that have looked at different models of hyperthyroidism. So hyperthyroidism caused by iodine deficiency versus chemicals treated to damage the thyroid. And they have basically shown, interestingly, when we sort of look at the science as a whole, they show that there's no impact. But I think it's helpful to kind of go through the studies because one of the things that we've talked about on the show plenty of times is the importance of looking at consensus and where the majority of scientific research lies while acknowledging that the study that maybe doesn't agree is still interesting and maybe shows some importance of context or nuance. So there was a 2018 study where they looked at thyroid function in rats, and the rats had either, again, iodine deficiency induced hypothyroidism, or they were treated with this chemical called sulfadimethoxine. It's a very long word that I don't intend to say again. And what they showed was that in the iodine deficiency hypothyroidism, that the rutabaga sprouts actually had a thyroid protective effect. So it actually helped reduce damage to the thyroid caused by iodine deficiency. And in the animals treated with the chemical that damages the thyroid, rutabaga sprouts enhanced hypothyroidism. But the same group did a follow-up study and showed that, again, like we've already talked about with sulforaphane, that the rutabaga sprouts reduced oxidative stress in the thyroid, again, through my favorite antioxidant enzyme, hemoxygenase 1. And that happened in both the iodine deficiency and the chemical-treated groups. They also showed a reduction in inflammatory cytokines, like interleukin-6, which we already talked about, as well as tumor necrosis factor alpha, TNF-alpha. And they showed increased anti-inflammatory cytokines, like interleukin-10. And interestingly, in this follow-up study, they showed that rutabaga sprouts had no hypothyroidism-enhancing effect in those chemical-treated rats. So the same group wasn't even able to reproduce their own results from the previous study. There was a separate 2018 study where rats were given freeze-dried broccoli sprouts that showed no changes in thyroid function in the control animals, and it protected the thyroid in, again, both the chemical-treated hypothyroidism as well as the severe iodine deficiency-driven hypothyroidism, and all of those same things that the other study shows, right? Reductions in things like interleukin-6. They showed actually that there was an improvement in thyroid enzyme activity with the broccoli sprouts. So they actually showed that it was incredibly protective. So what about humans? I think that's the most natural next question. This has been studied. So there was a 2019 study where they gave people high doses of isothiocyanates from broccoli sprouts and showed that it was safe for the thyroid, even in the context of autoimmune thyroid disease. So what they did was they had this fancy extract of broccoli sprouts. It was treated with the myrosinase to convert the glucosinolates into predominantly sulforaphane, which we already talked about. And then people were blinded, so they didn't know what they were getting. It was mixed with like pineapple and lime juice, so people were just drinking green pineapple juice or lime juice. And they were given a dose every single day for 84 days. So that's actually also a pretty long period of time. Remember that in the studies that we talked about at the beginning of the show, that we were seeing impacts from cruciferous vegetable intake in intervention studies like this one in as little as 2 weeks. So what they showed was in comparison to placebo, the broccoli sprout extract that was enriched with sulforaphane caused absolutely no change in thyroid lab markers. They also showed that, very fascinatingly, the percentage of participants that were positive for antibodies against thyroid peroxidase or thyroglobulin, the two markers of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, at baseline was no different 84 days later, statistically, significantly speaking. However, there was a statistical trend to a decrease, meaning, again, this is not statistically significant. They would need to do a larger sample size in order to tease out whether or not this was a real effect. However, there was a statistical trend towards there being fewer participants that met the diagnostic criteria for Hashimoto's thyroiditis at the end of the study, where they had 84 days of isothiocyanates that are supposed to be goitrogens compared to the beginning. So again, you know, we would love to see much larger sample sizes to be able to confirm whether or not broccoli sprouts could actually reverse early Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is what the study kind of implies. But we can for sure say that it didn't increase the production of antibodies against the thyroid or meaningfully change anything, any kind of measure of thyroid function like free T4 or like TSH. So there was actually also a similar trend, it's a statistical trend, which means the p-value is greater than 0.5. It usually means it's less than 0.1, greater than 0.05, but less than 0.1 is usually that range where we call it a statistical trend. But there was a trend towards a decrease in the number of participants with subclinical hyperthyroidism. So that is a thyroid that is not doing awesome, but isn't under-functioning enough to meet the criteria for hypothyroidism. So that gray area in between healthy thyroid and what would be diagnostically termed hypothyroidism.
Fascinating. So why do you think this is a complete aside, but why do you think it shows differently in test tubes than in humans? I mean, I know that this is a consistent scientific thing. I'm just, as a, like, curious person, I heard you say because our body has, was it an enzyme or something process-wise that changes the results where a test tube doesn't? Or I'm just wondering, like, where did this myth and rumor come from? Like, why? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think it came from both the observation that isothiocyanates, these glucosinolate metabolites, can inhibit the activity of one enzyme in the thyroid. The thyroid is really complex, right? It's a really complex chemical reaction to make thyroid hormones. And the regulation is not just one enzyme, right? The regulation is pituitary hormones and various selenoenzymes and both really high levels of iodine and really low levels of iodine can suppress thyroid. So, there's not very many people out there with iodine deficiency induced hypothyroidism, and the initial studies that led to potentially making an argument for avoiding cruciferous vegetables if you had autoimmune thyroid disease were done in the context of iodine deficiency. So also, that's not functionally what's happening in most people. Most people's Hashimoto's thyroiditis is not driven by low iodine, because iodine-enriched salt makes it very unusual for anybody to be deficient in iodine these days. So I think, you know, this is why it's important to fund replication studies. I could go on a soapbox for that for about 7 hours. But it's also why it's important to not just look at one study or two studies, to not just look at what happens in a test tube or what happens in animals, but look at the full body of scientific research, look at what's been done in animals in terms of understanding the mechanisms, right? So that's where these rat studies are really, really helpful. They show that there's a anti-inflammatory effect, and that it's that anti-inflammatory effect is protective for the thyroid in both of the ways in these animal models that they cause hypothyroidism, at least in 2 out of the 3 studies, and the other study couldn't be replicated even by the same research group. And it also tells us why it's important to look at the majority of studies, right? So this is why scientific consensus is such an important concept, because small changes in methodology, small changes in variables can change the outcome. And because the human body is so complex, that's why we want to examine the same question in multiple different ways to be able to really understand it. We can't just say, I have this one question, do cruciferous vegetables suppress thyroid function in humans, and do one study and be able to say definitively yes or no. That's why we want multiple studies performed by different research groups in different populations with different variables to be able to make a statement about, you know, the answer to that question with more confidence. One study is never a definitive study. We always look at the body of scientific literature as a whole, and that's why I put so much stock into systematic reviews and meta-analyses, because that's exactly what those studies do. They take the body of scientific literature, every single study that is trying to answer a question, and pools all of that information together to really tease out the results and kind of average out where variables might impact the actual results. So I can see where the origin for this myth is in the scientific studies. I think the really, really important information to know is that studies from the last 3 years have illuminated that problem and have expanded human knowledge in a way that makes us know now that people with autoimmune thyroid disease, you know, especially in the context of not having iodine deficiency, have no reason to avoid cruciferous vegetables.
Indeed. And I don't use salt that has been added with iodine any, like, right? Like, that was one of the things that I changed over in my focus on nutrient density, was to find like more natural salts. But iodine is also in seafood. Where else would one find?
So there is some iodine in unrefined sea salts. Oh, so if you're using Himalayan pink salt or French sel gris or Celtic sea salt, those all do have some iodine. So they have about 75% of the sodium of regular salts and a similar amount, you know, 50-ish percent of the iodine. So they still do have iodine. And actually, given how much iodine there is in iodized table salt, there are some researchers. I haven't dug deep into this data, so I can't make a statement on whether or not I agree, but there are some researchers who think that one of the reasons why we're seeing an increase in hypothyroidism is because of iodine excess, because there's so much iodine exposure from diets that are sort of rich in salty snacks and fast food and that type of thing. So there is iodine in unrefined sea salts. It's, of course, extremely high in sea vegetables. So sea veg salt. I really like the Maine Coast brand. They have a bunch of different options. But then it's like a finishing salt that has little tiny flakes of seaweeds. It's not a ton, but you're getting actually really good, not just iodine, but trace minerals. So you're getting, depending on the seaweed that's used, something like 80 different trace minerals from that little bit of sea vegetable that's on your plate that just has a really umami flavor, you know, when it's used that way. I like to add sheets of kombu kelp to my broth when I'm cooking broth, and that adds some iodine to my broth as well as, again, all of those different minerals. So that's another great little trick. And seafood is a really good source as well. So it's not actually, if you're eating unrefined salts, and you're eating a whole food diet that includes seafood, chances are really good that you're not iodine deficient.
Yeah, I love that. I use sea seasonings, but the sea salt with sea veg in it is, I honestly, even if you told me that it wasn't giving me much nutritional value, I would still, I love it on soups and rice, especially, and eggs. There's just, like you said, such a fantastic umami flavor. And it's really affordable, super, you can find it at like your local store. You can also get it on Amazon or wherever. It's highly recommended. But this is a complete tangent. So I guess the answer to Janet's question is, no, you don't need to stop eating cruciferous vegetables.
But don't bother juicing them. You're throwing out half the good stuff when you do that.
Thank you. Yes, you reiterated my original, the only moment of value that I've added here to the show. I think, you know, just in general, when we talk about juicing, we're not here to criticize. If you do something that you love, there are far worse things that you can do with your life than juicing. It's just like, why? You know, why get rid of the fiber and all that stuff? And I think it comes from this idea of vegetables being difficult to digest, which we have covered on all those shows that I re-mentioned at the top of the podcast, and is just, to me, I would much rather get the full nutritional benefits of the food as it was like put here on the earth to be made that way. You know what? Like I try not to have that like, well, just because it's old doesn't mean it's good mindset. But foods are synergistic for a reason. Like they complement and they come in multiple forms because oftentimes, for example, the fiber in a vegetable is doing other things of benefit. And it's not just for gut microbiome help. It's also sometimes has to do with how your body is going to absorb those nutrients or what it might be doing to blood sugar that you don't intend because it's a vegetable and different kinds of things like that, that juicing can have an unintended consequence. But I myself do love a smoothie. I will confess, I'll raise my hand. I'm not going to feel badly about it. I can get like 13 varieties of fruits and vegetables, and like 5 servings in, you know, just my breakfast and enjoy it. And so I'm all for putting some kale, in my smoothies. There aren't very many cruciferous vegetables that I like, but the other thing that I really like in my smoothies, Sarah, I know you're just going to facepalm, is riced cauliflower, because you can get it frozen and it's already like prepared and it works really well to create like a creamy smoothie. And Sarah's like, just eat the food, Stacey.
No, actually, I think that's a really cool solution. You know, I thought it would be a fun thing to do to kind of wrap up this episode with some of the ways that we, and creative ways that we use cruciferous vegetables. And as a non-smoothie person, I can say that I'm not going to be making a cauliflower smoothie anytime soon, but cauliflower is a really great place to start because it's so versatile. You can get cauli rice now in bags, most different grocery stores, and broccoli rice as well is out there, mm-hmm. As something that you can just buy. Broccoli slaw, I think, is an amazing kind of like noodle substitute. It's so good. I have a pad Thai recipe on my website, a couple of different ones that use broccoli slaw as a pad Thai noodle substitute. That's delicious. And I will use cauli rice as a soup thickener. So that's kind of, it's just, soup's just a hot smoothie with no fruit.
100%. My two favorite food groups, smoothies, yes, and soups.
So I love using cauliflower basically a substitute for sort of getting that creamy flavor. I make broccoli basically by just, you know, simmering cauliflower or cauli rice in broth until it's a little bit overcooked, and then blending it and adding salt until it tastes amazing. So as long as it's made with a really rich broth, it is absolutely delicious. And then I make a ton of different side dishes with cruciferous vegetables. Like we already talked about roasted Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are one of those foods. Actually, I would say Brussels sprouts, kale, and broccoli are on my shopping list every single week. I never know exactly what I'm going to make with them, but every time I get groceries, they are on that list. And then other ones like cauliflower, Romanesco, or bok choy are sort of they get featured regularly, but I kind of cycle through them. And then also things like arugula for salad, or watercress if I can find it. Watercress seems to be very seasonal. But I steam broccoli, I roast broccoli, I stir fry broccoli, broccoli is on my list every single week, and 3 or 4 of the bunches of florets is what I get every single week. That's what my family goes through. At least 2 bunches of kale, and I always try to get 2 different varieties. Kale salad is one of my go-tos. Yeah. My husband loves it so much. It's like one of his favorite foods. So I'm always really popular when I make kale salad. But there's just so many just delicious ways. I make a chicken stir fry with bok choy often. It's one of my I stir fry with cruciferous vegetables a lot. I just realized that, and just like straight up roast them are probably my two go-tos. But we eat, again, as I think I said at the top of the show, we eat a cruciferous vegetable pretty much every night for dinner. I don't think I'm super intentional with like, oh, here's our starchy vegetable and here's our cruciferous vegetable. I do tend to be intentional with a starchy vegetable and 1 or 2 other vegetables. But I think it just kind of happens to be that most of the time, one of the other vegetables on our plate or in the, you know, whatever the mix is, the soup or the stew or the stir fry or the shepherd's pie or whatever it is, almost all the time, there's a cruciferous vegetable in there somewhere.
I think from a like realistic perspective, right? Because a lot of people have desire to have these like fancy home cooked meals every night, but life is just not, maybe does not allow you to do that. Like, I get it. I'm over here living that life. One of the things that is really helpful for us is we get like Normandy vegetables that are like frozen, and we steam them. That's like my go-to whenever I'm like stuck for dinner and trying to figure things out. And I just make like a basic protein. And then those Normandy vegetables have both broccoli and cauliflower in them. They also have, I think, green beans and carrots for what it's worth. And like I said, I use frozen cauli rice, and there's so many like cauli things that are out there in the world, like cauli gnocchi and all of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I personally also really love horseradish. I will make myself like a horseradish like side, like a dipping sauce a lot. And so if you're kids have a hard time with vegetables, that's like the sauce that people dip shrimp in. So make yourself like a, you know, like a healthier version of homemade. What do they call that stuff? I don't need ketchup.
Cocktail sauce.
Yes. Yeah. You know, you can, it's just ketchup and horseradish and maybe some lemon juice and serve that. And then you're serving it with shrimp, which is, you know, you literally can buy bagged in the, you know, from a freezer and just like microwave it for a few minutes. There's a lot of, don't feel like you have to make a homemade soup or stir fry every night to be able to get these sort of vegetables in. I will say we do try to have a stir fry and a big pot of soup each week on our meal plan, just because it's a great way to use up vegetables and also to get a lot of vegetables and a variety of them into one dish. And then there's leftovers that people can have throughout the week or for lunches and things. So make the most of when you are in the kitchen working on these things. I will say my kids' favorite is like sauteed cabbage or cabbage that is cooked underneath chicken juice. So we have this recipe on the blog called bacon chicken, which then turned into like honey mustard chicken. And I think there might even be a third version of this because it's like so popular. People love it. But essentially you just put like a sheet pan, you lay the cabbage out on the sheet pan with like, you don't even need any seasoning. You can put some salt and pepper and stuff if you want, but the seasoning comes from the meat that you cook on top on like a raised rack. And so let's say you just put some chicken thighs on there and you flavored the chicken thighs and you cooked it, the drippings from the chicken will actually cook the cabbage and flavor it. And like, my children literally fight over who will get, like, we can't put enough cabbage on the sheet pan to feed our family. Like, that's how much people love that recipe. And it's so simple and so easy to use. So don't get overwhelmed by thinking like some of these studies that we were talking about, like up to 8 servings of these vegetables a day. And you're like, I don't have time to cook these foods, to eat these foods. You know, lean into the things that are easy buttons. And then over time, maybe you'll develop some favorite recipes or some habits that, you know, oh, if I make one big pot of soup a week, then I can have this dish a couple times a week and it has multiple things in it. Like Sarah said, if you use especially cauliflower, but really any roasted root vegetables, and you puree that into a soup, it creates a creaminess. So you'll find a lot of like dairy-free soup recipes on the internet that will use like pureed vegetables as the thing that makes a soup creamy instead of needing to add a bunch of dairy. So that's another way to get that in. And then you just have one thing that gets the job done all week long. So, and smoothies, I've already mentioned, I've become a smoothie addict in lieu of coffee.
One of the things that you said made me realize that it's probably worth talking at least a little bit about bitter super tasters as we wrap up this conversation, and acknowledging that there are people who have, there's a gene. It's kind of the same thing as like how some people think cilantro tastes like soap and other people think cilantro tastes like da bomb. And I'm in that latter group. But it's a gene that's altering the flavor sensation. The gene in question is HTAS2R38. That's the taste receptor gene. And, depending on which variant you have, most of us can taste that there's a bitter flavor to cruciferous vegetables, but some people are super, super sensitive to that bitter flavor. And studies have actually shown that bitter super tasters tend to hate vegetables and tend to gravitate towards sweet treats. So there have been a bunch of different studies looking at how to overcome that, basically. And so there's a couple of different strategies if you do realize that you fall under this bitter super taster gene category. So one is to blanch cruciferous vegetables before you cook them some other way. So that basically means throw them into a pot of boiling water for like a minute, throw them into an ice bath, right? Ice water to cool them down, and then roast them or add them to soups or stews. That will remove some of the bitter compounds and make them taste better for you. Another strategy is to balance that bitter flavor with something astringent or acidic. So, Stacey, you mentioned, sort of a vinaigrette, lemon juice would work. Basically adding something like that to the flavor. I love to toss roasted Brussels sprouts with just maybe like a tablespoon of balsamic vinegar for an entire sheet pan and a tablespoon of maple syrup. That is a really wonderful way for people who think Brussels sprouts are way too bitter to like really not just hide the bitterness, but also enhance the other flavors in that. And then studies have also shown that pairing a vegetable that you dislike, I mean, it doesn't need to be because you're a bitter super taster, but maybe you think broccoli and cauliflower are fine, but there's no way you're ever going to eat kale. Pairing that with another food that you do like, or a dressing that you like, or a dip that you like, has been shown in a variety of different studies to improve your taste for that vegetable. So you actually can develop a preference for it just by pairing it with something that you think is really delicious. So if you always have your favorite something else, with the cruciferous vegetable that you don't like, soon you start to associate that cruciferous vegetable with deliciousness, and then you start to like the cruciferous vegetable itself. So it's worth, even if you don't like one or more of this family, of finding ways to make it so that you do like it.
That's a good point too, because we talked years and years ago around salary amylase and how little children don't have essentially something in their saliva that helps break down and change the flavor of bitter foods. And especially something like broccoli is very hard for small children, not just because of that, but also because if it's raw or something, they don't have the jaw muscles either. So working with the flavors like Sarah, you just outlined, can really help them to develop, until they develop over time, more acclimation to it. That's a legit thing. It's not just children being difficult. there's real stuff going on that can change that. But I do think that walking away entirely from a huge group of vegetables can cause more harm than good if we can work around it and find accommodations. Another thing that worked really well for my kids was we made, it was like a broccoli raisin salad, right? With like bacon and raisins in it. So any way that you can add sweetness, it doesn't have to be like maple syrup to roasting, but it can balance out those flavors and make them a bit more palatable. So, all right. Well, I think we've covered literally everything we possibly could on this topic. If you have follow-up questions, please be in touch with us via our websites, thepaleomom.com and realeverything.com. I also want to remind you that we'll be popping over to Patreon, and every single week we offer an additional show commercial free over there on Patreon, and you can sign up for the year so you don't have to think about it and get our second podcast a week through that platform delivered to your inbox, or you can just sign up per month, I think, $5 a month, something like that. Mm-hmm. But we thank you so much for being here, and to Janet for asking her awesome question. We hope that you go forth, be it via soup or stir fry or smoothies or just taking a raw bite. We hope that we have inspired you to just go out and find some cruciferous vegetables.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. We love providing the Whole View podcast for you as a free resource. You can support the show by using the links and codes we share in our podcast. And we love to read your reviews and chats wherever you listen. And don't forget to share our podcast with your friends and family.
Speaking of chat, did you know that you can get exclusive behind-the-scenes content on Patreon? When you support us with your Patreon membership, you get access to live Q&As and weekly bonus audio. But they're not for kids' ears because our bonus content is explicit. You can also stay in touch with us via our social media channels. I'm at Real Everything Blog.
And I'm at The Paleomom. And we've got more great resources on our websites and in our newsletters.